Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and Steve Ember. But first, the Everyday Grammar Report with John Russell.
Do you ever hear a story and think to yourself, "I knew that," or "It's not surprising to me"? This week on Everyday Grammar, we will look at different ways to say that you are not surprised when you hear what someone says or does. One way to express this is by saying, "It is no wonder." The word wonder is often used in English to express a feeling of unpredictability or uncertainty. On a recent episode of Ask a Teacher, we explained how to use wonder in a question. When using the expression, "It is no wonder," you are saying you really have no questions at all about this event. On a sunny day, for example, you might look outside the window and say, "It's no wonder that the park is crowded. The weather is beautiful." Listen to the American singer James Swanberg telling about his relationship with a friend. This song says he's not surprised that they are together. Our next expression is "of course." You can hear this saying every day when someone reacts to a statement that is almost always true.
Ahmed stayed late last night to help with our project.
Of course. He's very generous with his time.
Another expression that you will hear when somebody is not surprised is "it figures." If you just look at the word "figure," you might imagine this has something to do with mathematics and adding up numbers. But in fact, the person who says "it figures" is putting together ideas and recognizing that their thoughts about those ideas are correct. The Canadian singer-songwriter Alanis Morissette tells about an incident like this in her hit song, "Ironic." The singer is telling us that she thinks, or figures, that bad things will always happen to her. Another expression used when someone is not surprised is, "What do you expect?"
"Those kids across the street are so loud."
"What do you expect? They're celebrating their graduation."
Finally, let's look at how people use the word "typical." It is often used when you are unhappy or dissatisfied with something that has happened.
"The bus is late, so I can't make it to the meeting on time."
"Typical. You should take the train. It's more dependable."
Now, let's review what we discussed today. The first two expressions, "it's no wonder" and "of course," can be used for an approving or positive reaction to an event. But the second two expressions, "it figures" and "typical," usually show more of a negative or not so nice reaction. Listen for these expressions the next time you are watching an American television show or movie. Try to use them when you are speaking English, and your listeners will know that you are not surprised. I'm John Russell.
A United States Secret Service dog that fought off a White House intruder in 2014 has received a top honor in Britain. The dog, named Hurricane, is a Belgian Malinois. He was honored with the rarely given Order of Merit Award from a British aid group. Hurricane is the first animal from a foreign country to receive the honor. The aid group is called the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals. The group provides free and low-cost medical care to animals and owners in need. Its director, Jan McLaughlin, said the Order of Merit Award is equal to royal recognition for humans. It's given for animals who show distinguished service for society, who go above and beyond that level of human and animal companionship, McLaughlin said. Hurricane was a highly trained member of the Secret Service, working as a guard dog under President Barack Obama. In October 2014, an intruder climbed over the White House fence during a night when Obama and his family were at home. The intruder was able to resist the first guard dog team that attacked. Hurricane and his trainer, Special Operations Officer Marshall Meraki, were performing support duties that night. So Meraki deployed Hurricane. "The second he got target lock, I sent him," Meraki told VOA. "He weaved through our teammates and took the individual down. But first, the intruder hit, kicked, and threw Hurricane through the air."
The individual wasn't responding to any pain for, you know, for whatever reason. So I had to sit back and kind of watch Hurricane go to war. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do.
Hurricane's mouth finally got a firm hold on the intruder's arm, and the dog forced the man to the ground. Officers moved in and arrested the suspect. Meraki said Hurricane was badly hurt.
To see him afterwards, after that happened, bring him back to the car, and have him look at me like, you know, you can read his mind. It's like, "Dad, did I do a good job?" He doesn't know he's protecting the White House. He doesn't know the president and his family are inside. He's doing that for me.
On his flight to London, British Airways gave Hurricane the royal treatment. That included a limousine ride to the airport and a seat on which he could stretch out during the flight. Meraki was seated beside him. The 10-year-old dog left active duty in 2016 because of health problems linked to the attack. He now lives in retirement with Meraki. I'm Brian Lynn.
Robert Kaplan is the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. It is one of 12 regional reserve banks that make up the U.S. Federal Reserve System, America's central bank. Kaplan met recently with a group of business owners and community leaders on Texas's Gulf Coast. He faced more questions on one subject than any other. It was not interest rates or economic conditions in the United States. The business leaders and local leaders wanted information about climate change. Texas has suffered disastrous flooding and billions of dollars in related losses in recent years. Now, it's hard to meet with a business person or a city or a community leader in this state who doesn't have questions on climate change, Kaplan said. He is a former investment banker and one of 17 Federal Reserve policymakers. In other states, people also are asking questions about climate change. There have been large fires in Northern California and bad storms along the coasts of Florida, South Carolina, and North Carolina. So the Fed's regional banks are thinking about how the changing conditions will affect U.S. businesses and the country's $17 trillion banking system. That is in conflict with the position of much of the U.S. government. President Donald Trump and his administration have rejected the science on climate change. But the Federal Reserve is not like other government agencies. It has more independence from the White House. The Fed's Washington-based Board of Governors is part of the federal government. Its governors serve 14-year terms, longer than any U.S. president. The system's 12 regional Fed banks are privately owned by local financial organizations. That independence gives the Fed a loud voice in local communities. There is a lot of information and statements being thrown around about climate change, said Elizabeth Chu Richter, a businesswoman. But the Fed is objective, she added. They work off the data they collect. Chu Richter attended the Texas gathering with Kaplan last month. Until recently, climate change research has not been a major issue at the Fed. Catherine Wolfram is with the National Bureau of Economic Research's Environment and Energy Economics Program. She recalls giving a talk at the Fed's headquarters in Washington in 2017. There weren't more than six other people who were even vaguely interested in the topic, she said. 2 years later, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco is holding a conference on the economics of climate change. There are no more seats available for the November 8th meeting. In the past, the San Francisco Fed has explored how to give banks more motivation to deal with climate change. Last year, researchers at the Richmond Fed found that hotter temperatures could slow economic growth. In January, the four living former Federal Reserve chiefs signed a letter pushing for a carbon tax. Such a tax would increase the cost of releasing pollutants. They said climate change was a serious problem calling for immediate national action. The U.S. Central Bank is taking climate change seriously, but it remains far behind other countries like the Bank of England and the Dutch Central Bank. They have called for action to stop the possibly disastrous effects of climate change on economic growth and financial security. Most G20 central banks have signed up to an information sharing group called the Network for Greening the Financial System. The International Monetary Fund also joined recently. Its majority shareholder is the United States. The Fed has yet to join. Some say it is because of the Trump administration's belief that climate change is not real. Adam Tooze teaches economic history at Columbia University in New York. He says the Fed does not want to get into an argument with the Trump administration. I'm Susan Shand.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about the War of 1812 between the United States and Britain. In the summer of 1814, the two countries opened peace talks at Ghent in Belgium. But Britain was in no hurry to agree on a peace treaty. This week, we tell the story of how the war ended. British forces were planning several campaigns in the United States in the autumn and winter of 1814. Successful military campaigns could force the United States to accept the kind of treaty Britain wanted. British representatives to the talks demanded that the United States give control of its Northwest Territory to the Indians. They also asked that the United States give part of the state of Maine to Canada and make other changes in the border. The Americans made equally tough demands. The United States wanted payment for damages suffered during the war. It also wanted the British to stop seizing American sailors for the British Navy. And the United States wanted all of Canada. The British representatives said they could not even discuss the question of stopping impressment by Americans into the British Navy, and the Americans would surrender none of their territory. Most of America's representatives had little hope the talks would succeed, but then Britain received word that its military campaigns had failed at Baltimore and Plattsburgh. After that, the British representatives became easier to negotiate with. They dropped their demands for American territory. The Americans then dropped their demands for Canadian territory. The issues that had led to the war no longer existed. Britain's war with France had caused the British and French to interfere with neutral American trade. And Britain had needed men for its navy. Now the war with France was over. No longer was there any reason to interfere with the trade of any nation. And no longer was there any need to seize Americans for service in the British Navy. On December 24th, the day before Christmas in 1814, the United States and Britain signed a simple treaty. Each side agreed to stop fighting. They also agreed to settle all their differences at future negotiations. The war had ended, but one more battle was to be fought before news of the peace treaty reached the United States. During the autumn of 1814, British soldiers at Jamaica began preparing for an attack against New Orleans, a city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Late in November, this force of about 7,500 men sailed from Jamaica to New Orleans. The British soldiers were commanded by General Edward Pakenham. The general did not take his men directly to the mouth of the Mississippi River. Instead, they sailed across a lake east of the city. Early during the afternoon of December 23rd, General Andrew Jackson, the commander of American forces at New Orleans, learned that the British force was near.
General Jackson was a good soldier and a great leader. He fought in the Revolutionary War, then studied law. He moved west to Nashville, Tennessee. The general also served in both houses of the United States Congress. When war broke out in 1812, he was elected general of a group of volunteer soldiers from Tennessee. Jackson was a rough man. His soldiers feared and respected him. They called him Old Hickory because he seemed as tough as hickory wood. Jackson was given responsibility for defending the coast along the Gulf of Mexico. Earlier in the year, he had attacked Pensacola in Florida and forced out several hundred British Marines. Jackson believed the British would attack Mobile before attacking New Orleans. He left part of his forces at Mobile and took the others to the mouth of the Mississippi. Jackson was a sick man when he got to New Orleans, and what he found made him feel no better. Little had been done to prepare for the expected British attack. Jackson declared martial law and began building the city's defenses. Most of the work on the defenses had been completed when Jackson got word that the British were only a few kilometers from New Orleans. "Gentlemen," Jackson told his officers, "the British are below. We must fight them tonight." The British soldiers rested. They believed it would be easy to capture the city the next day. But Jackson rushed up guns and men and attacked the British by surprise just after dark. Then the Americans retreated to a place about 8 kilometers south of the city. Jackson had chosen this place carefully. On the right was the Mississippi River. On the left was the mud and water of a swamp that could not easily be crossed. In front of the American soldiers was an open field. For 2 weeks, the British soldiers waited. They tested the American defenses at several places, but found no weaknesses. Every day, Jackson had his men improve their positions. At night, small groups of Jackson's soldiers would slip across the field and silently attack British soldiers guarding the other side. Finally, on January 8th, the British attacked. They expected the Americans to flee in the face of their strong attack, but the Americans stood firm. Jackson's artillery fired into the enemy. When the British got as close as 150 meters, the Americans began to fire their rifles. The rain of bullets and shells was deadly. General Pakenham was wounded twice and then killed by a shell that exploded near him. Only one British soldier reached the top of the American defenses. The British finally retreated. They left behind more than 2,000 dead and wounded. 500 other British soldiers had been captured. 13 Americans were killed. It was a great victory for the United States, but one that was not necessary. The war had ended by treaty 2 weeks earlier. Historian Alan Taylor says the peace treaty saved the United States from a very grim situation.
The United States government was bankrupt. It had lost its credit, and it could not raise enough in taxes for the war effort. And most creditors were refusing to lend any more money to the United States. And so it was very unclear how the Americans would conduct another campaign in 1815, because it looked like they wouldn't have the money for it.
The Senate acted quickly to approve the treaty. On February 17, 1815, President Madison declared the war officially ended. It had lasted 2 years and 8 months and united the American people. On the 4th of July in 1815, the nation celebrated its 39th anniversary of independence. In Washington, the man who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key, spoke at the celebrations. Historian Alan Taylor says, many people call the War of 1812 America's second war for independence, but he calls it America's first civil war. He says the country had been divided throughout the war, but things changed after Andrew Jackson's victory at New Orleans.
And so Americans then concluded that the war had really been a glorious occasion that had defended national honor and proved the merit of their Republican institutions. And they were so relieved by all of this that they decided to celebrate the war in their memories.
Albert Gallatin, Madison's Treasury Secretary and one of the negotiators at Ghent, said people felt more American after the war. They feel and act more like a nation. Alan Taylor says the War of 1812 was very difficult for the United States, yet Americans remember it as a feel-good war. At the same time, he says, the War of 1812 also united Canadians.
Despite all of their divisions during the war, they felt so relieved that they had fended off American invasion that they remembered the war as a glorious victory over the more powerful United States.
As a result of the war, Alan Taylor says both Americans and Canadians felt a greater sense of nationalism. And because of that, the two nations could relate more peacefully. Each believed it could survive without having to defeat the other.
And today, Canada and the United States are each other's primary trade and security partner in the world.
But not everyone benefited from the end of the war. The opposition Federalist Party found itself greatly embarrassed by the peace. Its leaders had long denounced the war and said Britain could not be defeated. Many of the Federalists had traded with the enemy. Some had worked with the British against their own country. They had even threatened to break up the Union. Once the war was over, the Federalist Party lost its supporters. And then the party itself soon disappeared, even in the New England states, its base of support. The end of the Federalist Party changed politics in the United States. The changes started as early as the next presidential election in 1816. James Madison continued the tradition begun by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson of serving only 8 years as president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.